Rolling Stone, Rolling Stone. Wanna see our pictures on the cover? Stone. Wanna buy 5 copies for our mother? Yeah. Stone. Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone? This is Dan Klingel, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Today we'll be reading from Rolling Stone magazine. This is a special collector's edition on Prince, the ultimate guide to his music and legend. The introduction is by Rob Sheffield. Prince spent nearly 40 amazing years on the front lines as the most maddeningly brilliant and unpredictable artist in the game. He built his own pop gospel out of his sexual and spiritual concerns, with a voice that was full of intimate affection, pushing emotionally further than anyone else. When he sang, it came on like kinda, sorta your best friend. He made the 80s best single, Little Red Corvette, and the decade's two best albums, 1999 and Sign of the Times. He changed how music felt and sounded. The news of his death at just 57 was truly heartbreaking because he seemed built to thrive into his golden years, an artist we all expected to remain prolific and independent and stubborn and gloriously himself for years to come. We all deserved a chance to hear old man Prince. This is what it sounds like when the doves cry. Prince was the artist in the 80s who kept everybody guessing what he'd try next, scrapping the formula he ruled radio with last year to try something different, dropping a new art-damaged yet chart-topping manifesto each summer, the way the Beatles and Bowie and Dylan used to do. In the 90s, he became the artist formerly known as Prince, began appearing with the word slave written across his face, and adapted to a new pace, no longer scoring as many pop hits, but still pushing and stretching with each album. His songbook is full of buried treasures like Dolphin on the Gold Experience, or Lay Down from a few years ago with the greeting, "From the heart of Minnesota, here comes the Purple Yoda." Rolling Stone was there for the entire journey. This special issue pulls together classic stories from our archives. In 1984, writer Kurt Loder was on the scene to tell the story behind Purple Rain. A year later, we were in Minneapolis for a revealing interview about God, sex, and critics. "I don't mind criticism," Prince said. "I just don't like lies." In 1990, we joined him on tour in Europe, where he spoke candidly about his artistic ambitions and celebrity frustrations. We met up again in 2004, when Musicology proved he was still on his game. And in 2014, senior writer Brian Hyatt paid a visit to Paisley Park for an encounter that was one of Prince's last major interviews. Of course, Prince really spoke through his music. "I make records," he told us. "I don't do interviews." So we've included a guide to his essential albums. There are also pieces that explore his film and TV appearances and his revolutionary approach to sexuality. To honor Prince's influence, artists like Questlove, Sheila E., Paul Westerberg, and Stevie Wonder have given us moving tributes to the man and his legacy. And Rage Against the Machine's Tom Morello has written an insightful piece on Prince's guitar playing. Throughout his life, Prince remained a mystery man who could reduce any room to rubble just by walking in. He made an unforgettable appearance at the Grammy Awards in 2015, strolling in and twirling his cane and giving a contemptuous eye roll, basking in his ovation and awarding Album of the Year. "Albums still matter," he said, "like books and black lives." And then he walked off into the night, one step ahead of everybody else, as always. This article is entitled Prince's Revolution, Rockstar, Funk Lord, Genius, Provocateur. He created a world, but in the end, he found he could only go it alone. This is by Joe Levy, and it's excerpted from Rolling Stone magazine of May 19, 2016. On Thursday, April 14th, at about 6 in the evening, a black SUV pulled up to the Fox Theater in Atlanta.
It was an hour before showtime, but Prince didn't need much preparation. This was the eighth stop on his piano and a microphone tour, a series of unusual shows, mostly two a night, that saw one of the world's greatest showmen scaling down his performance for an intimate keyboard recital. He only soundchecked for a few minutes. Lucy Freas, the promoter who'd set up this concert, tells Rolling Stone. As had been his habit for more than a decade, whether playing a 4,600-seat theater by himself or a 20,000-capacity arena with a full band, the shows were pop-ups arranged on short notice. Freas had gotten an email with the subject line Prince a few days before. Prince's team was looking for an independent promoter. Was she interested? She was on the phone 10 minutes later. The Atlanta shows had originally been scheduled for April 7th, with tickets on sale 9 days before, far more time than the 32 hours the Sony Center in Toronto had to sell tickets for a show in March. The Fox Theater sold out instantly, and Freas was already working on more dates in Philly, St. Louis, and Nashville, as well as a Miami arena concert. But illness forced Prince to postpone Atlanta for a week, and when he arrived that night, he still wasn't feeling well. "Don't worry," his tour coordinator told Freas. "Nobody will know. He'll perform, and he'll give it his all." When he came on stage for the first show, he seemed at ease. He greeted fans in the front before he sat down at the piano and launched into a version of Little Red Corvette, dropping in bits of Dirty Mind and the Peanuts theme. It was a mesmerizing hour in 20 minutes. Piano was Prince's first instrument. His father, John Nelson, had tried to make his way as a jazz pianist, so the night was a homecoming, a return to the source of all Prince's music. "My father didn't teach me that," he joked at one point during a playful elaboration on chopsticks. "I taught myself." Some moments it felt as if the songs were taking shape for the first time, brief hesitations giving way to new ideas. Others, particularly in the second show, where he played a driving version of Black Sweat from 2006's 3121 album, felt completely realized, his voice and the rhythms ground out by his left hand filling all the space. As with so many visionary artists, there was a period in Prince's career, almost all of the 1980s, when he seemed able to look around corners, when his music seemed to live in the future, and then assemble that future around us. Perhaps because of that, there were moments at the Fox Theater that feel now like premonitions. At the 7 o'clock show, he covered A Case of You by Joni Mitchell, long one of his favorite artists. The year before, Mitchell had been found alone and unconscious at her Los Angeles home, having suffered a brain aneurysm. She has since made a partial recovery. He also played David Bowie's Heroes, a tribute to an artist who had died just 3 months earlier and who had been, as Prince himself always was, restless and deliberate with his art and image, and who challenged the norms of gender and genre. The song is about the wish to transcend, to snatch a moment of glory that can transform the impermanent into the eternal, and Prince embodied the lyric, starting each line with a vocal stab that then floated upward. At the 10 o'clock show, his third and final encore began with Sometimes It Snows in April from 1986's Parade, a eulogy for the character Prince played in the film Under the Cherry Moon, Christopher Tracy. "Sometimes I wish life was never ending," goes the chorus. "All good things, they say, will never last." The show concluded with Purple Rain. Prince slipped in snatches from The Beautiful Ones and Diamonds and Pearls, then came back to the 1984 song that announced his ascension to megastar status. The audience joined him in familiar wordless falsetto at the end, hands clapping, voices lifted, and then it was over. 3 weeks before, following shows in Montreal and Toronto, he'd had after-parties at local clubs. At Toronto's Everly Club, the post-show jam came well after closing time. "It was 3 or 3:30 a.m., says promoter Robin Fogel. He had flown in on a private plane. He couldn't fly back until 6 a.m. because of airport curfews, so he just decided to play. In Atlanta, there was no after party. He went directly to the airport, and around 1 a.m., an emergency call came from the plane, which put down in Moline, Illinois. Though it would be dismissed as the flu, the same cause given for the show cancellations in Atlanta the week before, Prince was treated for a drug overdose, reportedly for the pain medication Percocet, at a local hospital. His dynamic stage shows had not been without a price. Sources say he had hip problems, possibly dating back to injuries sustained during the Purple Rain tour. He seemed frail but in good spirits the next night, Saturday, April 16th, according to those who attended a dance party held at his Paisley Park compound. He showed off a new guitar, but left it in the case. "I can't play the guitar at all these days," he said, according to longtime Prince chronicler John Bream's account of the night in the Minneapolis Star Tribune, briefly entertaining a crowd of 300 with his take on Chopsticks on a new purple piano. "Wait a few days before you waste your prayers," he told them. The following Thursday morning, April 21st, Prince was found in an elevator at Paisley Park. Sources say he had been living by himself in an apartment on the second floor in the back of the 65,000-square-foot complex, having torn down his nearby house in 2005, around the time of his second divorce. The last time he'd been seen alive was about 8 p.m. the previous night. A 911 call was placed at 9:43 a.m., but medics could not revive him, and Prince was pronounced dead at 10:07 a.m. He was 57. In Minneapolis that night, the streets around First Avenue, the club where the performance scenes of Purple Rain were filmed, were shut down as thousands of people gathered to dance and sing along to Prince's music. They were not alone. They danced in Los Angeles and in Brooklyn, where Spike Lee rolled up the garage door of his 40 Acres and a Mule production company, and a DJ blasted Prince tunes through the night. They were gathered to enact the music, which has always been about community, the utopias of musical and sexual freedom he called Uptown, Paisley Park, or Erotic City. He was rock's greatest trickster figure, the trick being that he could become whatever you imagined a rock star to be. "Am I black or white? Am I straight or gay?" he asked in one song. The only answer was yes. He shifted his voice from male to female and shrouded himself in mystery and impeccably tailored clothing, when he chose to wear clothing, selling fantasy in his music and image. Those fantasies were outrageously sexual and passionately religious, sometimes at the same moment. Rock and roll had always crossed the sacred and profane, so he upped the ante to the apocalyptic and the pornographic. More than any other 80s star, Prince brought the dreams of rock and roll past into the present. He wore Jimi Hendrix's coat, sported Little Richard's mustache, mastered James Brown's dance moves, and he did all this over drum machine beats, showing how the impulses of history could be turned into the sound of the future. "Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to get through this thing called life," he intoned at the beginning of Purple Rain, turning the album that had catapulted him to superstardom into a pop marriage ceremony. Whether the people listening were black or white, whether they were straight or gay, they were now bonded, their union consecrated by his music. Now he was gone, and so in Minneapolis, Los Angeles, and Brooklyn, they honored him in the only way that made sense, by dancing in the streets. Prince Rogers Nelson was born on June 7, 1958, at Mount Sinai Hospital in Minneapolis. From the beginning, he carried the hopes and burdens of his father's dreams. John Nelson led a group called the Prince Rogers Trio, though his day job was at Honeywell, a manufacturer of everything from thermostats to airplane parts. "I named my son Prince because I wanted him to do everything I wanted to do," John once said. His mother, Maddie Shaw, was a vocalist who brought to mind the wounded grit of Billie Holiday. She had sung with John's trio, but let it go after they married. The couple already had 5 children from previous relationships. Maddie was 17 years younger than John, and their personalities differed. "My mom's the wild side of me," Prince told Rolling Stone in 1985. "She's like that all the time. My dad's real serene. It takes the music to get him going." Wildness and serenity would be one of the many contradictions he embodied throughout his life. Music came to him young. "He could hear music even from an early age," his mother told the Minneapolis Star Tribune in 1984. "When he was 3 or 4, we'd go to the department store and he'd jump on any type of instrument there was, mostly the piano and organ. I'd have to hunt for him, and that's where he'd be, in the music department." When he was no more than 5, his mother took him to see his father perform. It was a burlesque show. As the dancers did their thing, the theater vibrated with screams and excitement. "From then on, I think I wanted to be a musician," Prince later said. Eros and music were fused, the power of the combination imprinted on his mind. It would never leave. Both of his parents were strict Seventh-day Adventists. Prince would say later that the most he got out of religion was the experience of the choir. He told Chris Rock on MTV in 1997 that the church's message was based on fear, but he took much from his Adventist Bible study. "The church focuses strongly on the book of Revelations and the imminent apocalypse that will precede the return of Christ." Prince would begin his breakthrough album, 1999, with a song that turned the apocalypse into a celebration. And his greatest album took its name from the Adventist magazine, Sign of the Times. When Prince was about 8, his parents separated. He'd later remember that constant arguments with his father's music career as a friction point. His father, quote, "felt hurt that he never got his break because of having the wife and kids and stuff," close quote. John moved from their home in North Minneapolis into an apartment downtown. He left behind his piano, and this is when Prince gravitated to the instrument in earnest. "I had 1 piano lesson and 2 guitar lessons as a kid," he told the Star Tribune. "I was a poor student, because when a teacher would be trying to teach me how to play junky stuff, I would start playing my own songs." By the time he'd reached high school, he had already mastered keyboards, guitar, bass, and drums. Not long after the divorce, his mother remarried, and Prince moved in with his father. Their reunion didn't last. When Prince was 13, his father kicked him out, perhaps because of a dalliance with a girl. Prince called him from a payphone, begging to come back, and was refused. "I sat crying at that phone booth for 2 hours," he told Rolling Stone in 1985. "That was the last time I cried." He moved in with his Aunt Olivia, but his domestic exiles created longing and anger that played out in his career. He would build a community in his music and his band, but then cut off band members whenever he felt it necessary. He would most often record albums by himself. He was the only one he could count on. "What if everybody around me split?" he said to Rolling Stone in 1990. "Then I'd be left with only me, and I'd have to fend for me. That's why I have to protect me." He was shy and quiet in public, but a cut-up with his friends. At school, he was a disinterested student. Music and sports were his passions. James Harris III, later known as Jimmy Jam, met him in a junior high music class. "As soon as the teacher left the room, we started jamming," says Jimmy Jam. "His keyboard runs were amazing, things I couldn't dream of doing, and I thought of myself as a pretty good keyboard player." Prince made the basketball team in junior high and freshman year of high school, despite being not much more than 5 feet tall. "He was a great basketball player," says Jimmy Jam. "He would come up the court and girls would be screaming. He had a huge afro, and if you had an afro in those days, it was definitely a premium." His first band came at 14, named Phoenix, then Soul Explosion. Prince played guitar. His friend, Andre Simon Anderson, later known as André Simone, played bass. When his aunt tired of the band's noise, Prince ended up living in André's house. Soul Explosion would rehearse in the basement. We used to have a philosophy that when everybody else is eating turkey dinner and watching football games and doing all that kind of stuff, we need to practice, says Simone. By 16, he was writing his own songs. The group became Grand Central, with Morris Day on drums. Then Champagne A demo session brought Prince to the attention of Chris Moon, who ran a local studio. When the rest of the band went across the street during a lunch break, Prince stayed back. I look out of the control room into the studio, and he's playing the drums, said Moon. Then I see him wander over and play a bit of piano. And then he stops playing that and picks up the bass. Moon wanted someone who could add music to some lyrics he'd been working on. He proposed a partnership and eventually gave Prince keys to the place. It took him about 6 months to master the studio well enough to run sessions for his one-man band, Adventures. Moon played a demo tape for Owen Husney, a Minneapolis promoter. Most artists, their sound would be derivative, Husney says. This didn't have that. He was attempting to create something new. And when I heard that vulnerable little falsetto voice, it was like, I want to protect this person. He signed on as manager and raised $50,000 so that Prince had new instruments and a place to live. Then he created an elaborate press kit to market the new artist. Warner's offered a 3-album deal and signed a 19-year-old Prince in 1977. The label wanted him to collaborate with Maurice White of Earth, Wind, and Fire. The ink wasn't dry on the contract, and he said, "Nobody's producing my album," Husney says. A session was arranged so that Prince could prove to the label that he didn't need help in the studio. He put down a guitar track and got it right, said Lenny Waronker, head of A&R for the label. He remembered, then he put down the drums. Wow, you could just tell. The guitar was locked in. The timing was good. You could tell it was easy for him. As Waronker left the studio, Prince told him, "Don't make me black." Growing up, Prince had been bused to grade school in a white suburb, listened to the Minneapolis rock station KQRS, and played Carole King covers in high school. He knew two worlds and knew there was more power in controlling both, not one. He ran down a list of artists that inspired him. Fleetwood Mac, Jimi Hendrix, Eric Clapton, The Stones. Warner's may have thought it was signing a kid who could play and produce his own work like Stevie Wonder, which would have been remarkable enough. Prince was putting the company on notice that this was only a starting point. It was not a smooth start. Prince's 1978 debut, For You, bounced with the hint of a new perspective, light pop melodies lifting up R&B grooves, rock guitar pulling them back down. But it felt airless, as if one man had locked himself away with these sounds for too long, which he had. Though Soft and Wet hit number 12 on the R&B chart, the album sold poorly. When Prince put a band together, Warner's wouldn't spend money to put it on the road. He needed his next album to be a hit. 1979's Prince was taut and expansive at the same time. Instead of typical R&B horns, Prince stabbed at his keyboards and guitar. The music nodded toward the post-punk pop of The Cars or Blondie. Its single, I Wanna Be Your Lover, topped the R&B chart and reached number 11 on the Billboard Hot 100 and would sell 500,000 copies. His next album, 1980's Dirty Mind, celebrated orgiastic pleasures, from simply doing it all night, to doing it in a threesome, doing it with a bride on the way to her wedding, doing it with strangers, and doing it with your sister. There was nothing you couldn't do, these songs said. The music was just as polymorphous. Ice-cold, new-wave keyboards were heated by funk guitar, and though some of the melodies had a 60s classicism, the sound was utterly new, so stripped down it almost sounded like dub reggae, a music of subtraction. On the album cover, Prince wore a trench coat over black bikini underwear. What audience was he trying to appeal to? Black? White? Men? Women? This would become the central dynamic of 80s pop, as Prince, Michael Jackson, and Madonna used music and image to cross the boundaries of race, gender, and genre in ways that electrified and united audiences. But Prince was there first with Dirty Mind. It peaked at 45 on the Billboard Albums chart, but its impact was bigger than that. The critic Robert Christian would call Prince the first commercially viable artist in a decade to claim the visionary high ground of Lennon and Dylan and Hendrix. That vision could not be contained to an album a year. He'd need more. After the Dirty Mind tour wrapped in April 1981, he wanted to create a funk band, and he approached the Minneapolis group Flight Time, including Jimmy Jam on keyboards and Terry Lewis on bass, with an idea. He'd write, produce, and perform the material. They'd sing and tour it. Calling the new band The Time, Prince recorded the 6 songs on their debut album in 2 weeks. Then in 10 days in August, he recorded his own 4th album, Controversy. Its October release coincided with an interesting invitation. The Rolling Stones wanted Prince to open their dates at the Memorial Coliseum in L.A. before crowds of 100,000 on October 9th and 11th. Prince opened the first show, which also included George Thorogood and the Jay Giles Band on the bill, at 2 in the afternoon. He came out with the trench coat and bikini briefs, says Jay Giles frontman Peter Wolfe. When the trench coat opened up, the audience didn't quite understand. People started turning on him, yelling, throwing things. Prince was unable to finish his set. 2 days later, things were even worse. Bottles flew at the stage during the first song, and Prince walked off in the middle of another. It was the last time Prince would open a show for anyone. After this, he built his own world. Prince began work on his 5th album, 1999, in early 1982. He was 23 years old and entering a golden period. For the next 3 years, it seemed like every waking moment yielded a song, and every song was a hit. He now had 3 groups, his own band, The Revolution, The Time, and a trio of women in lingerie he called Vanity Six. Before long, he would also be creating music for percussionist Sheila E. He was ceaseless, sometimes working for 3 days straight without sleep. "Do I have to eat?" he mused in Rolling Stone in 1985. "I wish I didn't have to eat." By the end of 1985, he had made 15 albums in 7 years, 7 under his own name, 3 by The Time, 2 from Sheila E., and 1 each from Vanity Six, Apollonia Six, and The Family. Those albums generated 13 top 20 hits on the Billboard Hot 100. Prince had gone after all this, but on his own terms. No one would have predicted that he'd break through with singles about the end times, or a sexually voracious woman, or that he could increase the power of his burgeoning fame by refusing to do interviews. Yet that's exactly what happened with 1999. He started work on the album at the Minneapolis home studio he called Uptown, and then shifted to Sunset Sound in L.A., recording so much material that he insisted Warner's release a double album. The label agreed. The album arrived in October 1982, and when he went on tour behind it, Vanity Six and The Time opened. His universe was taking shape. The shows were ecstatic. He was a guitar hero who could dance, bounce out of a split, and run to the keyboards to unleash another solo. And in the spring of 1983, radio and MTV embraced Little Red Corvette, flipping the switch on platinum sales. Prince wanted a mass audience as expansive as his vision for his music. Jackson, whose crossover juggernaut Thriller was released a month after 1999, was a rival. But Michael wasn't the biggest priority to kill, Revolution guitarist Wendy Melvoin said. It was everyone. The mixed-race, mixed-gender band Prince had assembled, The Revolution, was the first step. His dream was that we'd be Fleetwood Mac mixed with Sly and the Family Stone, said Lisa Coleman, who played keyboards. Said Prince, I wanted community more than anything else. Jams during sound checks were beginning to yield song ideas. The next album would be more collaborative than any he'd made. Purple Rain wouldn't be just an album. Prince wanted to make a movie as well. William Blinn, who wrote the first draft of what would become the script for Purple Rain, recalled how the story took shape when Prince sat at the piano to play Blinn some of his father's music and began to talk about his dad. It was as if he were sorting out his own mystery, an honest quest to figure himself out, Blinn said. Director Albert Magnoli spent a month in Minneapolis hanging out with Prince and his band, The Time and Vanity Six. He rewrote the script to focus on the musical rivalry between the Revolution and The Time, and the domestic drama that Prince's character, the Kid, endured at home. Hollywood studios weren't interested, and Prince's managers turned to Warner Brothers chairman Mo Austin, who put up $2 million against future royalties. It was a shrewd move. On a budget of $7.2 million, the Purple Rain movie grossed $68 million. The album went to number one and stayed there for 24 weeks, eventually selling more than 10 million copies. Prince had understood, as James Brown did when he cut Live at the Apollo in 1962, that if more people could experience the power of his live show, they would recognize how unique his gifts were. The movie gave him the fame he'd craved, and as the wild success of the album showed, it was once again on his terms. When Doves Cry was a more disorienting form of pop than anyone had ever taken to number one before. It had no bass, carried instead by strangulated guitar, the crack of Prince's trademark Lynn drum machine, and keyboards. And Purple Rain, which hit number two, showed how different he was from Michael Jackson. Jackson needed Eddie Van Halen to play guitar on Beat It, his rock breakthrough. The solo that blew Prince's rock ballad wide open was his own. The Purple Rain tour began in November 1984. I really couldn't liken it to anything other than the Beatles, says Alan Leeds, Prince's tour manager at the time. But those roaring crowds also marked the end of the golden period. Things would never be the same. In April 1985, Prince announced he was taking a break from live performance and released his seventh album, Around the World in a Day. He refused to let Warners promote a single or market the album in record stores. Thus did he begin a period of withdrawal that never truly ended. After Around the World in a Day dropped quickly from number one, he relented and let Warners focus on Raspberry Beret as a single and a video. It became a number two hit on the Billboard Hot 100. His connection with his band began to fray. He had elevated Wendy and Lisa to star status, an acknowledgement of their abilities and contributions, and a welcome sign that he could treat women as more than sex objects. Yet, they wanted more creative input and would leave in 1986 after his next album, Parade, the soundtrack to the disastrous film Under the Cherry Moon, which Prince himself directed. His last two albums had gone to number one. Parade climbed to number three and then no higher, despite its number one single, Kiss. When he told Warners his next album would be a triple album, the label refused. He had always gotten his way up to them, but Prince lost the fight, and so took shape a contradiction that had no undoing. The album that would prove to be his greatest work was also the proof that his power was no longer absolute. He pared the triple down to a double, Sign of the Times. It contained dreamscape pop like Starfish and Coffee, and the Ballad of Dorothy Parker, bedrock funk workouts like Housequake and Hot Thing, and a trio of songs that formed his most tender exploration of romance and gender. If I Was Your Girlfriend, Strange Relationship, and I Could Never Take the Place of Your Man. It stands as one of the best records of the 1980s, but he was no longer unstoppable. Sign of the Times peaked at number 6, and its fortunes might have been helped by a tour, but Prince refused to bring the production he'd mounted in Europe to the U.S. He opted instead for a concert film, shot mostly on a soundstage at his recently built Paisley Park facility in suburban Minneapolis. In 1987, he delivered a raw album called The Funk Bible to Warner Brothers, then experienced a late-night vision that convinced him the album was too angry to release. He asked the label to destroy more than 400,000 copies of what would come to be known as the Black Album. In return, he gave them a more spiritually and musically uplifting collection, 1988's Love Sexy. But he wanted all the songs grouped into one continuous track on the CD to control the listening experience. It failed to crack the top 10 of the album's chart, his first album since Controversy in 1981, to do so. Worse, the Love Sexy tour lost money. Angered that Warners would not let him release the music he wanted at the pace he wanted, he dropped his name for a symbol, thinking that his new glyph persona wouldn't be bound by Prince's record contract. When he found out that there was no freedom from his contract, he took to writing the word slave on his face. He became a figure of ridicule. "You're the only slave that owns the plantation," Alan Leeds told him. But in his haphazard way, Prince was a revolutionary. The relationship between labels and artists has shifted drastically in the digital age, and Prince's concerns about owning his masters and controlling his music are now common currency. In 1996, he ended his contract with Warners. It should have been a time of celebration, but it was marked by stress and tragedy. On Valentine's Day, he had married Mady Garcia, one of his backup dancers, and the couple were expecting a child. He spent the spring working on two projects, his final album for Warners, Chaos and Disorder, and a 3-CD set that would announce his freedom, Emancipation. According to Prince biographer Alex Hahn, on April 21st, exactly 20 years before his death, after what seemed to be one of his marathon 3-day working sessions, Garcia found him passed out in the Paisley Park studio. He was brought to the hospital, but when he regained consciousness, he wouldn't stay. That October, the couple experienced an unimaginable loss. Their child was born with a rare genetic disorder and died within a week. In pain, Prince refused to address the truth in an interview with Oprah Winfrey just days after the child's death. "Our family exists," he said. "It's only the beginning." But this wish was not to be. The couple separated in 1999. In 2004, Prince could claim something he hadn't enjoyed for more than a decade. He was the center of attention, and once again, it was for his music. On February 8th, he opened the Grammys in L.A., performing a medley of Purple Rain, Baby I'm a Star, and Let's Go Crazy with Beyoncé, and throwing in a bit of her hit, Crazy in Love. For 5 minutes, it was Purple Rain all over again, 24 million people watching in awe as he demonstrated his command of the stage. 5 weeks later, on March 15th, he was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in a ceremony held in New York. The night's highlight came during a rendition of George Harrison's While My Guitar Gently Weeps. Harrison was posthumously inducted that evening as a solo performer, and the song was sung by Jeff Lynne and Tom Petty. But the final moment went to Prince. It is a purposeful moment. In front of the keepers of rock's legacy, he stakes his claim as a guitar god. His playing is lyrical, full of power, as for nearly 3 minutes he makes his guitar moan and strut. "They rehearsed a bunch of times," says Paul Schaefer, the music director for the Hall of Fame inductions. But Prince kept a little something in reserve for the actual performance itself. At one point, he shifts gears so quickly, it sounds as though he's trading bars with himself, a one-man guitar duel. He had remarried in 2001 to Manuela Testolini, the same year he became a Jehovah's Witness. The faith lasted longer than the marriage. They divorced in 2006 after he demolished the suburban Minneapolis house they shared. He made Paisley Park his residence when not renting L.A. mansions for $70,000 a month. There were moments, like his majestic Super Bowl halftime performance in 2007, where he was center stage in the culture again. There was also chaos, much of it self-generated. His Paisley Park label folded in 1994, and there were layoffs at the compound in 1996. At the time of his death, it had ceased being a full-time operation. There were no longer engineers always on duty if he got the urge to record in the middle of the night, or any security, for that matter. There was Prince, his assistant, and someone to care for and run the building. On April 19th, Prince went to the Dakota Jazz Club in downtown Minneapolis to see jazz and R&B singer Liz Wright. He stayed for the whole set, a rarity for him, and left with a strut and his cane over his shoulder. 2 days later, he was dead. He was known to reject recreational drug use, but he is said to have had corrective hip surgery in 2010, and hip difficulties may have led him to painkillers. Prince's camp had contacted Howard Kornfeld, a California doctor specializing in addiction and treatment, the night before he was found dead. Kornfeld's son, Andrew, had flown to Minnesota and was to meet with Prince at Paisley Park on the day of his death. It was Andrew who called 911 when Prince's body was discovered. On April 23rd, a service was held at Paisley Park for Prince, whose remains had been cremated. "It was quiet and somber," said Sheila E. "The lights were dimmed. Candles were burning, just like Prince would have done. His music was playing at a low volume. There were very few people, and they're in disbelief. You expect him to walk out into the room and greet you. But if he greets us now, it will be through his music. There is, by all accounts, a vault of unreleased material, though its fate is unclear. It really doesn't matter. There's already enough, an overwhelming amount. It's said that there was a point when he made one song, at least one, every day, as if he was guided by that line in 1999 about how we're all running out of time. And we are, but the music keeps going." All of the other articles in this Rolling Stone issue are too lengthy to conclude in the time we have available, so I'm simply going to continue with the next one and we'll break when it's appropriate. This article is entitled Purple Majesty. Just before Prince became a movie star, Rolling Stone took a long look inside the life of rock's most fascinating enigma. This is by Kurt Loder and is excerpted from a Rolling Stone magazine of August 30th, 1984. "Prince has come. It's a warm summer morning in the Minneapolis suburb of Eden Prairie, and a black-clad rider on a purple Honda has pulled up to a nondescript modern warehouse on Flying Cloud Drive. A photographer has flown in from Toronto with an assistant to photograph Prince for the cover of this magazine. A standard rock star shoot, he figures, scoping out the concert-sized rehearsal stage, the costume room, the banks of musical equipment. When Prince walks in, the first thing the photographer notices is how small he is. He seems slight even in his 5-inch stiletto heel boots. He's wearing a dramatic black hat, a skin-tight black shirt open to the navel, and tight black trousers ringed with ruffles from the knees down. He seems to be saying something. Hi? He speaks so softly that the photographer actually has to lean down to within several inches of his face to hear him. He's making it quietly clear that while he has agreed to pose for the cover, he will not pose for any photos for the magazine's inside pages. It is decided to wheel in the purple Honda, a perfect prop. The motorcycle is a central visual ornament of Purple Rain, Prince's custom-tailored movie debut, a picture with so much pre-release topspin, as they say in Hollywood, that the media, anticipating a major sleeper, have been abasing themselves for weeks in the hope of wangling interviews with the recalcitrant star. But Prince does not do interviews anymore. Quickly, the photographer snaps off some preliminary test shots with a Polaroid. Prince seems to approve of the results, then slips away. An assistant appears and carefully confiscates the 7 Polaroids. When Prince returns, he seems restless and even more remote. He decided he doesn't like the original setup, so they do another Polaroid, a full-length shot. Prince disappears again. The photographer hears the sound of drums and cymbals being bashed in another room. Then there is silence. After half an hour, the assistant reappears and announces that he's just driven his employer home. Prince, he says, is extremely sensitive. He actually gets physically ill at having his picture taken. On his way out, the photographer can't help but hurl a silent curse at the warehouse walls. They are all lined with photographs, all studies of the same smooth, unsmiling features, the same inscrutable sensuality and unfathomable flamboyance, all of them dominated by those liquid, keen kid eyes, all of them pictures of Prince. Just who is this self-enveloped star? And how is it that he is outselling both Bruce Springsteen and the mighty Jacksons in the record racks? The picture one acquires of this 26-year-old wonder kid from scanning his songs and canvassing his colleagues is murky and uncertain, which is just the way he wants it to be. To most of the record-buying public, Prince was and remains essentially a mystery. In fact, about the only thing on which his friends and even his foes agree is that Prince appears to be the genuine article, a musical genius. And not since the 50s, when that accolade was applied to Ray Charles, has the term seemed so attractively apt. Prince has been riding a rocket to the top. Though his debut 1978's For You was not a commercial triumph, it included a carnal classic called Soft and Wet. His next three albums all went gold, and then in 1982 came the dazzling 1999, a double record set that is still on the pop charts more than 90 weeks after its release. In the view of Warner Brothers, it marked the long-awaited point at which Prince's fusion of white rock and roll and black dance funk became commercially undeniable. And it was seen as setting the stage for Prince's next album to create the kind of cultural explosion that traditionally heralds the arrival of a true superstar. But there was one unknown and slightly troubling factor in this commercial equation. Along with his 6th album, to be titled Purple Rain, Prince would have to deliver a feature-length movie of the same name. Filming had begun in Minneapolis last November 1st, and details of the project were not such as to excite keen anticipation among music biz money men. The director, Albert Magnoli, had never been in charge of a feature before. The cast, including all 5 members of Prince's band in key roles, had, with only 2 exceptions, no acting experience. The tight budget, $7 million, and rushed shooting schedule, 7 weeks, did not augur well for stellar production values. And of course, whoever heard of making a movie in Minneapolis, in the winter yet? In addition, the script was said to be autobiographical. William Blinn knew nothing about Prince, really, when he was approached roughly 2 years ago about writing the script for a vaguely conceived movie in which the singer would star. But Blinn, a mild, middle-aged man who'd written such Emmy-winning tube fare as Brian's Song and a Roots segment, had reason to be interested in the task proffered by Prince's management company, Cavallo, Ruffalo, and Fagnoli. At the time, Blinn was executive producer of the Fame series, and there was some doubt as to whether it would be renewed for a 3rd season. A screenplay would be a handy diversion. What did the managers have in mind, exactly? That was unclear. Prince had been jotting down ideas in a purple notebook for some time. One night on the road, he told Steve Fagnoli, "This is great and all, but there must be something else." He wanted to do a movie. The managers would finance the film themselves, but they needed a script. Blinn first met with Prince at an Italian restaurant in Hollywood. He immediately knew there'd be strange days ahead. "I never met anyone in the world who ordered spaghetti with tomato sauce and orange juice to drink," he recalls. As they talked about the movie, Blinn found that Prince was not conventionally accessible. It was as if I asked someone what they wanted for dinner, and they said they weren't sure, but they'd like it to have some tomatoes in it and some beef and some onions. And I'd say, I think we're talking about beef stew here. During a meeting at Prince's home, a purple but otherwise unremarkable two-story affair on a lake in a well-to-do suburb several miles southwest of Minneapolis, Blinn realized that an important part of the story Prince was trying to formulate concerned his father, John L. Nelson, a piano player who led a Minneapolis jazz trio in the 50s under the name Prince Rogers. Nelson separated from his wife, a singer, when Prince was 7, leaving a piano behind for his son to learn to play. The father, who reportedly still lived in Minneapolis, obviously remained a troubling figure. He was semi-communicative about his dad, says Blim. He played me his father's music on the piano, and when he talked about his father's life, you could tell that his father is very key in what he's about. It was as if he were sorting out his own mystery. He saved all the money on shrinks and put it into a movie. Blinn began pounding out a script called Dreams, a dark story in which the parents of the kid, the character to be played by Prince, were both dead, the mother dispatched by the father, who in turn killed himself. Prince's Minneapolis music scene was in there too, and so was the beautiful Vanity, lead crumpet of Vanity Six and Prince's girlfriend, or one of them. In Dreams, she was to play the stabilizing influence in the kid's otherwise chaotic life. Blinn's story was beginning to sound very much like Prince's life. Following his parents' breakup, Prince had been bounced from mother to father to an aunt and finally at age 13, of his own volition, into the home of Mrs. Bernadette Anderson, the mother of his best, and at the time she says, only friend. Prince and Andre Anderson had both attended a local Seventh-day Adventist church as young children, and they shared an interest in music. It was with Andre and a young drummer named Morris Day that Prince organized his first band, Grand Central. Music is obviously a cloak and a shield and a whole bunch of things for him, says Blinn. It's a womb. Halfway through the second draft of Dreams, Prince told Blinn he wanted the word purple in the title. At first, I thought it was a kind of strange request, Blinn says, but he really identifies with purple. There's a whole dark, passionate, foreboding quality to the color and to what he does. Yet there's a certain royalty to it, too. After finishing a second draft of the script, Blinn got word that Fame had been renewed for a third series, and so he returned to television. Prince's management team was left with a script of sorts, but no director. After seeing a film called Reckless, they approached its young director, James Foley, and asked if he'd be interested in Purple Rain. He wasn't, but he recommended his friend, Magnoli, who had edited Reckless. At first, the 31-year-old Magnoli wasn't interested. Nevertheless, he agreed to meet with Bob Cavallo for breakfast one morning. Cavallo asked him what he thought the Prince team should do. I said, this is what I would do, and right there I told him the entire story. I knew they had this character, Prince. The script had introduced me to this other character, Morris, and I knew there was a girl in the middle. So it was like, where do you go with this? And I said, Prince should do this, and Morris should do this, and Vanity should be this kind of girl, and not this other thing in the script. Within 10 minutes, I'd convinced myself that this would be an extremely exciting film to make. Cavallo liked what he heard, and Magnoli felt the stirrings of a buzz. He agreed to fly to Minneapolis. The minute I met Prince, I realized that I hadn't gone far enough. We had dinner, and he let me speak for about 25 minutes, and I began working off what was emanating from him. The father became a musician. The mother became sort of a woman wandering the streets. Things like that. And at the end, he said, okay, let's take a ride. So we took a ride, and he looked at me, and he said, I don't get it. This is the first time I've met you, but you've told me more about what I've experienced than anybody in my life. Magnoli told Prince that if he was willing to reveal the emotional truth of this material, then the movie could be made. Prince agreed, So Magnoli went to Minneapolis and hung out with the people who would populate the film. Prince and his band, now called The Revolution, Day and his group, The Time, the women in Vanity Six. Then he locked himself in a room for 3 weeks and completely rewrote Blind's script. In the completed Purple Rain, the kid is an up-and-coming attraction at the First Avenue and 7th Street Entry Club, where he revels in his burgeoning musical powers, despite the derision of the club's manager and the petty humiliations inflicted by a hilariously snide headliner, played to near perfection by Day. Offstage, though, the kid is miserable, plagued by his parents' incessant domestic rows, increasingly alienated from his own band members, and awkward and inarticulate in his pursuit of a beautiful new arrival on the scene called Apollonia, the part originally intended for Vanity. When Apollonia announces her intention to join a girl group being assembled by Day, for the express purpose of dislodging the kid from his slot at the club, the kid, like his bitterly abusive father, lashes out at the woman he loves. Meanwhile, Day and Billy, the club manager, keep up a steady assault on the kid's fragile ego, chorusing just the sort of criticisms that have been directed at Prince himself over the years. "Nobody digs your music but yourself," says Billy. "You long-haired faggot," screams Day. Following an explosive encounter with his father, the kid redeems himself with Apollonia and blows away all competition at a climactic concert. It's not a happily ever after ending exactly, but when Prince and his band dig into the luminous title tune at the end, a definite feeling of uplift is imparted. We will continue reading this article, Purple Majesty, in our next session. This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org, left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then, under Programming Links, left click on Demand Podcasts. You can also now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.